Well, it's a pleasure to introduce Kathleen, and I'm glad to see people here. Kathleen has been one of the central presences in a number of poetic communities for a couple of decades now, and the position that she's occupied, I think, is a rather crucial one, because the community of women poets and innovative poets, or to put it other ways, experimental writers and writers concerned with social location and identity are crucial constituencies in American poetry, but they're not always on easy speaking terms. And it seems to me that Kathleen has, in a number of ways, has been doing crucial work in trying to write a kind of whole poetry for a whole society, a utopian ambition, but why not, you know? somebody has to think like that. I mean it's hard to do, and it's a heroic thing to try to do. So books include, what, how many books have you published? 7, 8, 9, something like that. 14? Most recently, there's a selected from Wesleyan, how do you say it in Italian?
Il Cuore.
That's right. Il Cuore, the heart. Right. It's just my Italian that I'm anxious about. Anyway, and that is for sale here, as is When New Time Folds Up. I think those are the only two that are for sale. In addition to her poetry, which is lyric, innovative, ethical, lots of adjectives I could put in, but I'll just let her read the poems. I just want to mention her work as an editor of However, a really crucial journal that she started in the Bay Area in the 70s, and co-editor is here, if I'm not mistaken. And there's a new incarnation of this journal, How To, which is H, capital H, small o, small w, numeral 2, which is available on a website as we speak. I don't remember you've got a flyer that you're going to pass out about this. So I think without more ado, I'll turn it over to Kathleen.
I'll put the flyer right over here. It has the web address, the URL as it's called, and there are some seats up here. The issue number 2 was, if all goes well, since I've left the city, it will be up tomorrow. So hopefully you can look at it. Number 1 has been up for a while, but I don't know, these things are so labor intensive that to try to get the word out is a whole other project, just like books, you know. You finally get the book done into the publisher, but then to try to get it distributed and is another task altogether. I too am glad there are people here tonight. It'd be a little alarming. I've had the alarming experience twice. Once Bob Gluck and I gave a reading at the University of San Francisco, and it was impossible to find the place. There were no signs, and we finally got there, and there was this vast room, and we were on a stage with a big podium, and there were 3 people. And we got there very late, so, you know, people weren't going to be straggling in. It definitely helps to have people to read to. I'm going to do about a half and half program of poems from this selected, which spans 20 years, 70, 25 years. In that section, I'll do a few from a book that came out in 1974, and a few that came out in 1980, and a few that came out in 1984, just to give you a sense of some of the stuff that I was doing. And then the second part of the program will be new work that hasn't been published in books. Il Cuore, the heart, is titled in 2 languages because since 1980, One, I've been living a lot of time in Italy, and since about 1984, I began living there 4 months a year. And it is a real life, and I work there, and I now speak Italian, and I have many friends there. And everyone says, so how was Italy? It's the worst question, because, it's my life, you know, like San Francisco is my life, or Philadelphia is your life. You keep on going. But I found that after I'd been there a while, and when I was really learning the language and beginning to dream in it when it was coming up that way, that especially if I was writing work that had to do with my contemporary life while I was there, which often would involve the architecture of the city, the history, I mean, as detail it would be there, the visual detail for sure, that that Italian words would come up. I wouldn't be searching for them. They would just come up in the place where I wanted. Ice cream would be gelato, which we all use here anyway. But there were things that just would be there, especially in stuff about the neighborhood where I was hearing people talk all the time. So I decided when I put this, well, first of all, I didn't have a title yet. And then my friend Joanne Ugolini, who also lives in Rome sometimes, did this painting, which was in a show of hers, which was done collages that were done from regular political posters and all kinds of things that are up on the walls of stores in the neighborhood where I live, along the Viale di Trastevere. And I loved this particular painting, and I don't know what the origin of the poster was, but it has the word Il Cuore, which is kind of painted over, but you can see it coming through. And it was right from my neighborhood, and she collaged over it, and I bought this out of her show. And then I thought, why don't I name the book that? Because Trastevere is the heart of Rome, one of the hearts. Rome has several. And I thought that, since I don't have a poem by that name, but that it would be an interesting way to characterize an ongoingness. So I'm going to start with an early piece. I've been working on a paper about Lorene Nydecker, or Nydecker, depending on where you're from, how you say it. And I chose this piece because I've been thinking she's characterized in a narrow way, I think, a more narrow way than who her work really is, what her work really is, who she is. And I think that I learned a great deal from her at a particular time in my development as a poet. I can't separate where Oppen left off and Nydecker came in. I could if I really took a long time, but I don't want to do that right now. But there's a kind of clarity of language and a paying attention of detail. And hopefully that there a complexity is beneath that. But this is very located in the daily. It's called Little Notes to You from Lucas Street. And it's a series of 12 very small sections. And it was written, I'm not going to give long descriptions of everything, but I'm kind of warming you up to this. It was written when I was teaching at the Iowa Writers Workshop. And very soon after I got there, and it was a strange place. I'd never been, wonderful strange place, but I'd never been there. I didn't have any friends. I had a very small child. And my sister died within 3 weeks. She got cancer and she died just like that. And I had to go with my small child to New York City and see her through that time. And when I got back, I felt extremely disoriented and extremely distanced from everything. I mean, I felt sometimes almost slightly crazed, but I managed to keep a social presence. Because I had to, I was teaching and I was, you know, representing all these different things there, and I didn't think I was writing poetry then, but I was making little notes in my journal, and after I began teaching formally second semester, and that's what got me back into my life was my contact with my students. It was great and life-giving, and then I was fine again, but. I went back at a time after that and looked at my journal and realized I had been writing poetry. I had been writing what I would now put into a poem, which I might not have considered at that time to be material for poetry. And also this kind of directness of it, unnegotiated by any kind of, what, elaboration or literary whatever. Okay. Little notes to you from Lucas Street. In iris mud, her legs stems, and separate even, if it's afternoon, by the porch. Still, her curls are just unwinding from the large size pinks. Plastics fresh as spring. Mud rushes up in her throat. There's a song she's trying to remember. She knows it's there. Her boys are there on each muddy bike. Red paint and blue paint, bicycles, the sun's out as a presence of snow running. I don't know where I am. Bread rises and smells. Only half an inch of pink detergent, and my hands compose with two oranges. Is my mouth a pocket? Its mystery a presence as separate as the porch? The children in our puddle walk reverently in green and red sweatshirts. Somewhere a switch disconnecting. Along the white edge of snow light, nothing hurts. Call me with your danger. Red, deep red, anemones, purple anemones. We watch them float somewhere near the center of the table. Anne is getting married. The petals, dark, tensing center. Are you the mysterious presence? One always waits. The possible new thrill could be licking a stamp. Seeing again, the tension stretched so exquisitely pale, it almost disappeared behind love. And the one thing you never tell me. Your knees move in spite of you. They reveal the shape of your face. On the bus, we showed off our children. See, I can play mommy and daddy. Long, glossy cars at ease in the parking zones, always gliding through the temporary zones, stopping firmly before the nonstop zones. Their confidence tilts, the only balance one has mastered. Change stools here at the water. I always go here for the water. This poem was written during the, I don't know if any of you would remember this, maybe a few of you, of the gasoline crisis. It happened, I think, sometime around 19, let's see, this was in a book. This came out 73, so this book came out in 74. And so I say that because you will hear a few little references to it. This is coincidental, and this is a more rollicking movement. I'd say I was still under the quite wonderful influence of Frank O'Hara, which was a big first influence for me, or that whole thing, but really him and Barbara Guest, those two, which were completely diametrically opposite. That's what I want to be. I aspire to be diametrically opposite. Coincidental. Half of my friends accuse me of excess, waiting online and trusting in inches. The other half lean and have given up glossy fenders with their little pockmarks of rust. It is comforting to know that these same accusations keep company among the ducks fighting for bread from your fingers, using their beaks with concentrated fury. Revulsion has been mainly a failure, and so has dabbling, while exactness can rest in one hand smoothly as a fertilized egg. Without knowing, one might be listening for the crack, which would merely indicate a vulnerability, the delicate parabolic strength in the egg's curve, beyond our power to reduce it. Physics becomes more cheerful each day and delights in breaking the laws of nature. While quantums flow backwards, our children on skateboards are pulled up into the sky in the same way that Christ was swallowed by white clouds. One might call this a sort of rapprochement, the unthinkable light. You must elaborate or ascend. One chooses to pay attention to the movement, an output of plant roots or the possible expansion under each arm where the breath might flow freely and in dignity. We feel how all the little clutches of the body seem finalized, as though some law of physics told us to hold ourselves tightly and not let any part fall out, any messy tear. Rigorous methods have been established to capture the elusive, a fanatic devotion to statistics and controls, but we secretly pray to ghosts as they hover among the teeth of gears. We feel our muscle systems quivering as though trying to get loose. A great urge to be down to earth seems to show up in each generation. You can slice it as you would a flatworm for a microscopic study, or shuffle it, or randomly select well-bathed individuals and place them in an antiseptic atmosphere. And still, the tiny jiggles of light persist, as though some precedent of joy insisted on having its way. A full tank, a sunny day, a mailbox stuffed with envelopes. That's when mailboxes were still stuffed with envelopes instead of email screens. Okay, moving to 1980. I'm leaving some books out. These were the poems that on the way here I thought I wanted to read. There was a piece by Lewis Hyde. I can't remember the title now, but I read it. I started reading it. It was in APR sometime before 1984. And I got through about the first three sentences and I stopped because I immediately, what he was talking about, which was language acquisition, which Rachel has also written about. And I started thinking back to this time when I was between about 1.5 and 3, when my father ran a neighborhood house in Chicago. He was studying, he'd been an architect, and he suddenly made this decision to serve people instead. And so he went back to Union Theological Seminary and started studying Greek and Hebrew and various things and theology and philosophy. And I was in that stage where I was pre-speech and then coming into speech. But I was very visually acute, apparently, because I had all these memories from it. And this poem is about that, trying to talk about, I mean, it's coming out of that. It's not about it. It's coming out of that. How do you talk about, how do you find a language for talking about experience when you didn't have the language at the time, and somehow still capture some movement of what was going on? The name of the poem is Lena Pergola, and that was the name of my babysitter, which I should have known would foretell my future of living in Italy. So, Lena Pergola. When he uses the word it, clatters, it returns loud where the word is a marble. The word will never come back, but any word it does use, back does come back. When I'm lying in my crib, was hands wrapped around inside white mittens cotton not to get out. Waiting we feel, but not when the Chicago L goes by against the window. Crib tied on outside track, light tied to inch, infinite exactly inch, feeling bars of it separate. He kept saying suddenly it wasn't a river when it was ice. His voice was never there all the time. The light was yellow, the crib bars were white, the L went up, we were in my buggy, everything was in air, and the same size, little particles of black, but in the white. She jumped out from the dark. Her name is Lena Pergola in the hallway. She liked to eat spaghetti. There were big spoons and all the spaghetti for everyone falling off itself on the platter with red tomato sauce. She hitchhiked with someone handsome like my uncle who shaved. I stood in his bathroom first. I was almost up. Steam all over the air and sweet bottles. You like me, huh? Thinking someone was Jesus again and Daddy had chances, keep saying suddenly, who out from the dark hallway, very long with light, some to see the something behind it, the dark boo or moo, who you is to be nice and told me about first and things I didn't dark, not go, not a moment of down the stairs and down the elevator, up the door where light is out after they tied you not to suck thumb. I was white. I was inside a closed bite. Of God, any small, any will have wings or a he or under the bed with crown and scepter, both king and queen in dust cloud and black or mouse, not stared at anything. Don't look, it is under the corner or keep saying suddenly why the tidy way in the white sink day, the silver razor pulled down his cheek, black trousers, white undershirt. Things go happen. A go long hallway on the road and music inside his horn. Lena, Lena, Lena Pergola. His words stink, she said. My hands tied. Take the L. Go up. Oh, can you, have you been hearing me or not hearing?
Oh, okay.
For taping. Oh, yeah, it's different now. Well, somebody who is hooked on the color red is just coming into your blue room, which ruins another person's life. You can get right off the hook. To put out his own scare, you have a child. Enough of these goings. You'll proliferate now, the thoughts misbegotten to strike through every face truly, people whom you are. Getting on with this blank, are you saying one should follow when the position comes? I think that door is closed. If only he didn't close. You shouldn't waste metric time. The mental passage is somewhat over. That will occur to you strongly. Nobody's knocking. How do you say, bring in folks? One guy, breakthrough. We all go up and everybody gets his limit and his hope. Your empty page needs voices and very little to do, where you stand off base, forming various whites from the window. Females who have never lived a female life when in fact they need two. What you'll refer to, a dream of separate rooms, the red room, the blue room. You're in the present. That little place opens when you drop inside. Your fresh start. Those were from 1980. I made a mistake. Now I'm going to 1984. And this book I'm going to read from now was definitely a kind of perfect example of what a conflict I was in as a poet at that point. I was still writing hot, emotional, what I would call poems of necessity, where I was struggling through to try to, you know, I was trying to be inventive and write things in a different way, but I still wanted to have that necessity that was in my life, a kind of emotional base there. The second half of the book was a very long piece, which I didn't include in this book. I would have included, I really liked the piece, but they only gave me, they gave me my limit and my hope, 200 pages, including all the, you know, stuff that they put in the front and the back. So I had to, and I was writing long pieces and I had to cut it out, but it's in the book. that this other half is in. By the way, and the two things were divided in kind of a spine of a poem for Francis Jaffer, which was called Medusa. It's in here. I'll have to tell you the title now, because it's, where is it? Yeah, Medusa's hair was snakes, was thought, split inward. Now, the first half of the book was from this group of poems called Something Even Human Voices in the Foreground, a Lake. And it's all written in prose sentences, and which was definitely happening a lot around the Bay Area. And of course, I was madly tempted. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, one gets so tired. If you came out of a lyric tradition, which I did, I was so tired of, it's not that I thought I wanted to write lyric, it's that those habits were still in my ear and they kept pushing me around, and I was always trying to figure out strategies to get away from them, but I loved sound, you know, and so I kept, it was definitely a big struggle, which I have continued to work with since I was conscious of it. But this seemed a good solution to write in sentences, because you wouldn't have to, you just wouldn't have that concept somewhere in there trying to make you, you know, make the line, that self-consciousness about the line and everything, certain sound things that come in when you're working in the line. Okay, so these are each have a title, and they were written really in a very much of a witness position, which is the poet's position anyway, at least half the position. But it was my second or third summer in Italy. At that time I was only going in the summers. And I barely had any Italian. I thought I was doing fine till I got there. I'd been studying classes and listening to tapes. And you get there, and everyone in Rome, I mean, people just speak differently. It's like a whole, it's like going, I don't know, to the Bronx or the South or something, where people just have a different sound than people do in the Midwest, which is where I'd spent time. So I was listening, and what happens is, in Italian society, is on the weekends, people always go to Il Mare, or the mountains, and I was with a group of friends, all Italian, who kind of adopted my husband and me. It was amazing. We could barely speak, but they liked us and kept inviting us, and so we liked going there. It was so interesting and different, and it was at this great place. It was right on a lake, and you could just go swim. Which I spent a lot of time swimming, since I couldn't speak or understand what they were saying. But fortunately, they knew I was a poet, and they thought that, I mean, they were kind of terrified of that idea, because none of these people were literary types at all. But they also really looked up to it, because it was Italy. They thought being a poet was a wonderful thing. So I would sit there, and the women would all sit in a circle, and the men would be over doing their thing, but they would always be female and male, constituted in that way. And the women would be talking about who knows what, you know, little chit-chat stuff, which is the hardest to get, whereas the men would be talking money, sports, politics, and I could understand that. You know, that was all recognizable because the language is different. But the little, what do they call it, chiaracuras? It's hard to remember that word. That's what they were doing. Anyway, I wrote all these while I was sitting there, and they thought I was just writing in my journal. And meanwhile, I'm writing down all this stuff that I'm thinking about and that I'm imagining that they're saying, and I'm watching them display themselves continuously in their bikinis, and they just are always matching their tans, and they're amazing, this group of people. And I would say that most Romans are like this. They're very narcissistic, very childlike, and just completely warm and wonderful and lovable. So that's a background for this. And I'm not going to read, I'll read some sections. Something Even Human Voices in the Foreground, a Lake. A definite mountain, the upper with tableau, foul water. The air was back of the house, my niece suite, intervening roses and heavy hanging apricot boughs as the morning advanced, an imposition of isolated will upon the deck chairs, the docks, and fragments, even human voices. The watery glitter of bits of food afloat on the water's surface, that hole the size of 50 cents in someone's childhood. You always called, "Here, little fishy," when you dropped the orange and green flakes into the round opening. I often looked for a dead one. Even a light bulb fooled me. "You were glad it wasn't what you thought it was," you told me. You were accurate, but on another morning I noticed, while sitting in a chair, listening to you speak a halting Italian on the borrowed telephone, a small silver fish with clouded eye lying back to back with its reflection. Anything is interchangeable with a small net. You know that. They did not make conversation. A lake as big, the early evening wind at the bather's neck, something pulling, or was it rising up, green from the bottom. You could lie flat and let go of the white creases. You could indulge your fear of drowning in the arms of shallow, wet miles. You did not open your mouth, yet water poured into openings, making you part. Bone in the throat, that dark blue fading, thinning at the edges. On deck chairs with bits of flowered cloth across their genitals, the guests called out in three languages and sometimes pointed, commenting on the simple beauty of bought connection. The swan-like whiteness of the day, that neck of waves. There was always a tray with small red bottles and pinpointed attention at each slung ease. Anna in lawn chair endeavor. Anna extended brilliant legalities cast in her secret place in the mountains with another's white satin gown against the bluest shadows, their uniform extended limbs and tiny leaves impressed by a suggestion. Raking that space between us, Anna, our teeth, Anna, and your glittery rings showing all you don't have, oh, the collar folded. Body's little mistakes won't look at you now. In the corners, never in sneakers, you prowl the page of a large, heavy man and wish to be a signature he could touch and remember later and pay for. Becoming famous and powerful. To each other, she is as if the sun were oddly powerful, born in her palanquin mind, her grammar moving in the lag into a narrower cut, slammed on a map of fixed color, crimson, perhaps, like a tear in the surface of isolation, her brain, the extenuated appreciation, the cold space it leaves as it blows by. Oh, happy speed, marshes here, mahogany blue boats for 1 foot, startled by that flatter water's intimacy, clenched in the same style he remembers. Beautiful hair to take care of. The selfish, ruined shine of her. The sun opens and begins to work. Not quite rubbed smooth, increased in size, they talk often of the old marriages. A boy with black hair is younger when he looks in the window into what is darkness later at her legs, in which she concentrates all of literature, rearranging how and what to yell at him. His face shifts and reloads the rectangle holding the frame's air. Where he was, voices shouting from the opposite window. You know them. Anna, are you looking at me? If not, a lack of confidence stiffening this path, this patch of hand over the body's bronzing. Abbronzato, working at it. And you like it? Her leg aside his arm, arm against friends, galactic and childish in white, while pulling at him, blinking little nipples before the keyhole drift, where he lifts a path of white to display what is his little worry. All your hoarded blemishes could be big ones gathering a life subcutaneous against you. The man in red bikini buys you houses. You show your present, then he takes it away under that smile and a change of clothes. Turquoise bikini rolling over from the day confirmed as yesterday. Neither headlines nor even finer print. Looking for Ponentino, little western wind to us, lifting your dress for them. She drifts in from bath in Hollywood white satin, and already you are craving it. But you can buy anything and think it doesn't work. Working out once, the glaze pulled back its gauzy robe, but you would not give what was yours much. Covertly, her husband's eyes. The boy with white apron hurriedly, tray in hand, the usual small coffees and head not visible due to position of green shutters, his red comb. Later in tents, looking too big for the body. Something has leaked out. I could have gone away. Dropping precipitously into the other life, uniformly spaced drinks and a heavy leaf supporting this September air. Oh, receive us, house and terraces. Open 9 light bulbs and let the doors have crossed locks. This second language accommodates more bathing. You offer cheese, which you have divided to keep us hungry for a later precise event. Small pyramid, marginal attention. In the left-hand margin of her ivory gown, purchased at great expense and with a certain spontaneity, the flea from someone else's couch, perceptibly there in its brief jumps. This was her vacation and the source of future recountings. They learn the latest dance, how to shoot with bows and arrows, take pictures of themselves doing these things. The certainty of Byzantine tendencies, she reads. The sweet curl and cold cove of acanthus, oh, leaf-bearing thought in stone, when we consider what has stood, strokes the feather in her pocket. Gift of thumb, its opposites, time inside a person, worn threads of your cape dazzle us, oh, lover of birds we didn't notice. Our muscles ache from the simple climb. These stones, the length of tubs with their tiny ridges, catch us. Behind shutters, the dark. Eyes of she who cuts and washes. Cuts and washes. That's a description of Gubbio. Stunned, no, I'll just read the last one. In white, she who bathed. Everywhere, rooms are leading to other rooms. The brain, she thinks, is her corridor and her strict casement when she is a window. It is believed that she understands partially but cannot speak, except haltingly and about nothing in particular. Okay. I'm going to read two more pieces. I'll end on a poem. And I will read a prose piece, which is 6 pages. Can you tolerate that much? This is a piece that has a lot of room in it, and it's called Soft Pages, and it was printed in Common Knowledge, a handsome journal, which I hear is going out of print maybe, or at least for a while. Well, I had it marked carefully, and now it's not there, wouldn't you know? I was quite happy because they wrote to me, and I'd been sent a copy or something. I admired the journal, and I thought it had a very interesting group of people editing it. And they said they were interested in experimentalist and innovative poetry. And I had been recommended by someone like, I think, Marjorie Perloff or someone like that. She's always doing great recommendations for everything in the world for everybody. Anyway, so they wanted a poem, and I didn't have anything that I hadn't already promised, or I'm not one of those people who wakes up every morning and, I wrote the new poem. I had the only thing I had that I really, really liked that was very new was this piece, and it's prose. And it's not, I don't consider it a poem, I consider it a piece. It's not a story, but I thought, I'm just going to send it and see what they say, see how really experimental they are. So I sent it and they took it. They were just really happy to have it. Okay. Soft Pages. It was that motion of the back foot caught in the photo as a blur, more believable in quickly conveying a person's leaving who had once been on his way, even anticipating this place, that continued to re-enter my imagination, as if the black and white photo of no one I knew had delivered the plot of a story it wished me to take hold of. This was not about desire or choice, the two preferred categories of explanation for my life. In conscious moments of trying to make sense, or at least an admirable clarity of things, but about dropping into a place after that. This was not the brass plate special, desire, in embossed black capitals, the nameplate attached to the hallway door of apartment number 5. This was before desire, but after choice. Voices cutting through the air above the paper passage. Voices one can hear every afternoon at just this hour of 3:40, when certain neighbors whose doors face Via Luigi Santini rise out of their random snores and leave their rooms for the street and sniff the air like dogs and start barking like dogs, not knowing why they bark, except the need to push one's snout at the unnatural silence and move it around. That same moment being the one in which their sharp and muffled barks have pulled me into inexplicable pleasure. And then a siren goes off as if its car were being broken into. Needing something, the cheap lined paper of those little bound notebooks imported from Germany one finds in certain shops in Rome with cover stock of pseudo-Florentine design, somewhat faded looking as if a businessman from Lubeck in love with the expensive papers of Florence, but more than half in love with profit, had finally fixed upon the Lepidoptera wing scales pattern, but had opted for its recycled version in bleached out cost-effective blue. I allow for that economy. A more expensive paper would dazzle you with perfection and inhibit you with its emptiness. I've found also that certain writing implements may make the difference between jumping or falling. The particular receptivity of cheap paper to soft lead or the tip of a rollerball pen can pull one into the page's porous expanse, not exactly sinking into it, but not floating above it either, more like losing the sense of confine in my quasi-second language, indicating the border between two countries. I've noticed, too, that the particular angle of my body in a certain rattan chair purchased in Rome at one of those chain stores owned by a certain disreputable politician, recently deposed, allows some entering into the liquid element, liquidation or sequential randomness, but I always trusted my dreams and never thought of them as abandoned film clips. One might cast off in classical terms, as in the crossing from land to water, before you've noticed, which would remove an action's intentionality, or at least alter it. I lift the red panties with satin stripes, earlier tossed on the green radiator, along with various pairs of ankle socks, among them the black cotton streaked with yellow and vermilion, still damp from the morning's rain outside in the cortile. Touching them, turning them into their folds and rolling them into neat little bundles for the drawer. Some grayness begins to fall. I can see its motion sideways from the window, the graininess of newsreels from the Second World War, and I know it's more rain. No sound of voices barking, having gone in again, an animal gratitude. By realistic representation of the foot, one woman said it was a man's foot in motion. I'm sure of that. One could be helped, technically, into a different century, just as introducing the words the Peloponnesian Wars or World War II can pull you into a discrete flow of time assigned to a displaced fragment. Pelagic, if that's how a particular moment keeps continuing without one being able to stop it, either around you in the world or stuck in the ongoingness of your mind in a decade preceding you, you trying to pull away from it or it coming towards you in slow and fast motion, even as you walk towards the most simple morning task. An earlier war could attach itself to the odd assignment of time before now, not yours, called turn of the century, as could the spliced image of a centaur attach itself to a monster. The new construct born into overlay as word or demonstration of the mind's ability to jump or grasp more than one thing at a time, this horseman turning away from or leaving us with its, his, path of motion as inadmissible evidence, but also the blur of discrete categories forced into coupling. Today, walking with you alongside and then across the Circo Massimo at an angle down from the upper track and over the grassy slope to the site of pre-Christian games of prowess and midnight movies in 1983, looking for the odd bit of archaeological evidence, finding an almost buried slab of Roman brick underfoot, wanting the smaller scale and ordinary blue of the wildflower next to it. Not as definite as departure. Already it was following the camera's path, its ability to bunch up time, capture it incrementally or smoothly into successive unfoldings, compression fanning out through heat-laminated brick, golden fade-out into transliterations of pale fan sent from Tokyo, held in place by a thin loop of silver paper just at its breaking point until the restraint had been lifted away to release the motion of unfolding. Someone wanting the prop in cultural time. May I demonstrate my lineage? Her feet were already in motion when she placed the fan in a silk brocade box inside another box of smooth cardboard and then a third of good brown packing stuff and addressed it to me, smiling to herself while her family awaited her presence at an elaborate dinner staged at the younger sister's house where servants never turned their backs and the chauffeur put his best foot forward for foreign guests. A house in which certain concessions were expected of her, the eldest sister, in spite of her reputation for eccentricities, travel in plastic shoes, and the courting of adversity. What shoes was she wearing, walking up and down the hills looking out at our blue water? Her secret was not evident, and I could only try to imagine it, even after she told me. Her feet inside and outside of her grandmother's feet, the unbreathing ligaments of even earlier feet in courtly brocade bindings, toes shrunk from the confined pressure of silver loops, the framing of the holding, the plot's single-minded ground, toes now open as a fan to catch light, the unveiled light in her motion away from it. I've understood, too, that writing on a lined page, particularly within the covers of a notebook, has provided me with a landscape of continuous blue horizons, below which I can sink, above which I may again rise, so that each line, extended and wrapped into the next, enacts a kind of hope, a proof that life below the horizontal does exist and may arise of its own motion or impetus to continue, as in breath, over which we have little control, although we can learn procedures directing it to foreign anatomical regions. Today, our yoga teacher focused on our feet, showing us how to massage the bottom of one foot and then the other as if it were the palm of a hand, from the center towards the toes, with a slow, steady upward circling, then directing us to a point below each toe as it joined the trunk of the foot, if toes were branches, then to bring pressure, followed by an extended pulling and quick snapping motion of each toe. Circulating chi, she said, all of us in a line doing this. If you sat in the line of bodies on mats in the yoga studio under the windows of the far wall, facing out to afternoon light, just gathering around petals now covering every visible branch and already shedding on paths, also striking brick apartment buildings behind those trees, but stopping short of the river, whose length and reflection must have contributed to the luminous wave and particle motion in the studio, you could feel only half of that light because your back was turned against the source of shifting and pulsing inside the room. Whereas if you sat facing the windows with your back against the opposite wall, as I always tried to do, a different fullness became part of the experience of the room and of the yoga postures as well, a kind of visual presence or figure for the low sound of tablas and stringed instruments coming from a concealed tape deck as if voices calling after something ahead of them. My mat was the blue one with my name written at one end, directly onto the foam rubber in the wide stroke of my teacher's felt tip pen, and I always looked carefully, once I'd unrolled the mat in the place I'd mentally marked as mine, to find among the various colored blankets she'd provided in a wall cupboard at one end of the studio a soft blue plaid that would draw me into a state of calmness, as if the water in the river were also blue instead of muddy, and the sky an intense wintry cloudless blue instead of burdening the urban landscape with its heaviness of pale and dark gray storm clouds waiting to break loose. This is what I said about the foot, the man's foot in motion. That is, this is a sentence, once a part of what I wrote down or revised over several days, at least 3 years ago. This image from another's postcard photo, or it may have been a painting meant to reassemble the accuracy of photography, now both itself and the 50-word statement I'd prepared for my friends who gathered to share their sentences, limited only by the number of words we'd agreed upon, as if in surprising ourselves, skidding into the next arbitrary place, we might extend presence, just as the man's foot, for me at least, seemed to express a form of desire in the motion of leaving or arriving. I want to insert the sentence of the foot here, but must find where I put it, maybe in a file folder in the other city where I sometimes keep things, in the cardboard box or the blue plastic vegetable container from the San Cosimato market, left next to the dumpster. But lacking the sentence of that particular man's foot, both its movement in relation to the wall behind it and the way it stuck out from the bottom of a trouser leg, which would have been gunmetal gray in a sort of late 30s, mid 40s cut because of the World War II dread that seeped into me from it, not thinking about it then, but noticing it later, looking back. I will mark this space as a kind of geometric memory bank, not so much to contain or trap the sentence, but to give it a place to rest once I find it, or even where it might reconstitute itself outside of the context in which it was first discovered. The sentence, of course, will be different once it has been retrieved. Its placement will change it, but also what has happened to me since writing it may affect my degree of discomfort towards it. So the reserved space, I've chosen a rectangle box-like container for it, and I will draw there, might also stand in for something just below the horizon about to rise towards me. But if its substance is represented as that which resides inside the rectangle, isn't it immediately superseded by a symbolic or at least geometric reference to the authority of some earlier contour, even Euclidean in nature? And where does that leave me? I mean, my sentence. When I find it, or even if I simply know that it is in a place where I've stored it, will it still be connected to a pre-existing intelligence network, as soft and wet and tangled as any recent technological advance? I must remember to enter the narrator's life in as many ways as possible. By must, I mean that I crave intimacy and little corners, but take even more pleasure in distancing devices while sniffing the smell of leftover shampoo on a person's damp terry cloth robe. I mean that I want to interrupt with a personal detail. I was stunned, for example, by the exact moment in a recent fictional work when a woman notices her foot stepping up onto a curb and understands this to be an event. It was not so much the physical presence of the foot. No, that's wrong. It was the physical presence, even though we are given no details. But at precisely the same time, as in both sides of an equation, it was her knowing she knew, her discovering for herself the nature of an event, or that this particular moment or emotion had any importance at all to her in a world of rain and cars, influenza and the new skin product in its opaque blue glass bottle about to shatter on the edge of the tub, having fallen from the window ledge, a spiritual crisis disguised as diminishing counter space for appliances and other material goods not mentioned. It had happened, had been happening. An incremental shaping, a turning movement. You could also say that something suddenly leapt forward in the dark theater, and that what had been the curb now became a screen with her foot projected onto it, just as it was lifting and setting itself back down. The screen was carried inside her, it having already installed itself, forming its contours again and again. But the light falling on her foot, as it appeared to lift of its own volition, as a separate animal even, made it seem as if the projector was also hers, illuminating the moment which had been gathering in her, yet not hers, until now. In the middle of this account, the body rises of its own accord to stretch. No yoga today. No ice drinks, sore throat, and every surface feeling cold against the skin, something obdurate, the nature of early spring, wind, and one's resistance to or inability to resist it, body oversensitive, even wrapped in long wool coat. At the market, feeling vulnerable in exposed parts, air against face and hands, and grateful for his body guiding me along across wet, rough surfaces, watching to keep me from slipping, skidding on square stones of little Roman streets. Man with horse and cart trotting along in traffic. Centaur, my century, about to turn. The whiff of red tomatoes still attached to the vine with some acrid odor, the same as my father's victory garden so carefully tended. War stamp days, little green beans in the market today, mushrooms stuffed with condimenti. Behind the flower sheds next to the iron railing separating the market stalls from the children's play area, a monster with a man's head and trunk, a horse's body and legs. His head emits a kind of music. He loves the romantic theme songs of American movies of the 40s and whistles as he sharpens knives against a device powered by turning above a bicycle wheel he pushes, his hooves pressing the pedals in place, whistling those old tunes from Mussolini times, but always off key, monstrous to a tuned ear, my sweet. Last thing I'll read is a poem, and it's called AD Notebooks, AD standing for Alzheimer's disease, and it was written, the note on the back says, this poem for Willem de Kooning and Marjorie Fraser, who's my mother, stricken by Alzheimer's disease in parallel time. Quoted passages from Willem de Kooning and Robert Storrs, parts 2 and 4, part 7 from Kenneth Baker. This was occasion while I had been living with my mother's condition for about 3 years, and I knew of de Kooning's illness and had been reading about it in various art journals and at the new San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, which is quite a beautiful building and space. There was a retrospective show of de Kooning, but it really had an immense number of his most recent works. And some of those remained at the museum in their permanent collection. But there was a very big hoo-ha around his later works. A lot of critics were being very snide and nasty and saying that this work was clearly the guy, you know, didn't have it anymore because he didn't know what he was doing and they didn't look like the old things. And I went to this show and I was completely stunned by it. I thought it was a fabulous show. And I'd been looking at his work quite carefully and quite continuously since the early 60s. And so that was one thing. Another thing was reading these different accounts. And one of them was a very interesting accounting of someone who worked in his studio and had spent time with him and videotaped him working in the years up until about probably until about 5 years ago, or maybe until the 1990 for sure, in the period of the 80s when he was working, doing most of this work. And that clearly showed his intentionality as he was working. I mean, he would work, he would then take off stuff, and then he'd work again. And he clearly was looking for something very particular, knew what he was doing, not in the period of this time, just, you know, in the say 90 to 95 or so, but in that period of time, he did know. And that kind of confirmed my feeling when I'd been looking at the paintings, because I just, there was something else too, another kind of documentation, I'm blanking on in the middle, maybe it'll come up as I'm reading. So anyway, the other thing that brought me into writing this was a visit to my mother in which she definitely no longer recognized me. And that was a very, very odd feeling. And I wouldn't say, I would say that the sadness came much later. I mean, I really, she's still living, and it's, I had to spend a year grieving for her death because I couldn't call her on the telephone. You know, I couldn't, I mean, I was different identities to her. I'd be her sister or her mother. And, you know, depending on who I was, she would be very angry at me or, you know, somewhat happy. But anyway, this, if you've never experienced this, it's quite a strange, disorienting experience to learn how to relate to someone that you've spent a good part of your life with, and everything changes. But what I'm struck with in her anger, because she had some terrific, what would I call them, storms of anger, and it struck me how close her face, that what was coming off of her face and in her eyes, how close that was to certain paintings of women that de Kooning had done in the 50s that I had seen, that I had looked at really a lot, and the resemblance there. And that's what clicked in the thing of wanting to write about both of them and the illness and his painting, and being at the, visiting my mother in this place where she is in a wonderful place in Pasadena, California. Couldn't be a nicer place. So I imagine him as being a person here too, in this is a kind of imaginary, but it's not a big character portrayal, but I mean the person in there, the male person in there is an imaginary him. The quote at the beginning of the poem is from Kenneth Baker, who was writing about de Kooning, and the quote is, "The fear of outliving one's own mind." Notebook 1, Wonder Guard. It's a little bracelet that they have to wear, so in case they disappear somewhere, the electric signals will go off and people will know where to find them. Wonder Guard. If it has a hallway, I keep it. If it doesn't have a hallway, I keep it. I don't go off. She sets off and comes back and sets off. Cloak and hover, sheep together in hills of plastic, metal. Hand me your arm, leg, how glimmer in milk their sponge. Cleaved clover body, over now we get our little airy cream. Hand me your, they're dyeing me orange, is it the war? When we press orange dye doo-doo into plastic thigh? Can't go in or out without him. Can't get in or out, can't get out, get out. By the outbreak of the definite, we refer to tine of fork. And won't eat that thing called word, 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 sliding over it, pearls, glistening chlorine, pink and yellow shine, white passage, exhaled and gone. Notebook 2, Radiant Inklings. She may be tipping from the sidewalk, or I'm falling. Cement is under us, but grass must leave it. Pink falls, is sanded, flooded, erased, and then falls again. I sandpaper my children. My son is at the edge of the sidewalk and would blot it roughly with a paper towel. Because when I'm falling, I'm doing all right. When I'm slipping, I say, hey, I'm really slipping most of the time into that glimpse. Mr. Kooning. When the airplane's flying over the camellia bush, when the airplane is next to the orange tree, it is next to the rose blue pool full of ozone. And I see no one who is I, no body swimming where I was, who was contained. The appearance of his arrival shimmers, but the grasp of it separates itself from the event. The event's trajectory or possible history remains athletic, but static. You yourself may remember a map in which the colors bear no relation to the terrain they represent, the ocean growing lighter and lighter, or its depiction traced on thin paper hangs over it, touching and leaving a smudge. If the picture has a countenance, he said, I keep it. If it hasn't, I throw it out. Yet his desire for her presence remains in him until his arrival, at which point she cannot sit still and must hurry towards a point of light at the other end of the hallway where they lead him to his brushes and his imagined light he carries in each step to her door. He keeps in a shut paper bag his red and yellow crayons from school, weighting him down, which proves the law of usefulness. Notebook 3, taking away. She must be mother light, traded in for lover light, God in Chicago light, let there be word, food, red, and God. Every Sunday, borrowing him back. Noon's chicken, over them noodles too, and finally alone. Lead kindly light. I could draw a line with my crayon, but the other lines are swallowing it. Then a little humming and some pop sound pulls sideways and I'm gone. Notebook 4, the erase. He erases her. Erases her. Then he takes a little part and blows it up as if she were floating from a string in a scraped patch or corner of an old 50s month. When he then erased up her body, which he has now entirely replaced. Notebook 5, in spite of gradual deficits. Through deep parabolas of air, you swim up to her. The room says, I'm a little bit out of this world. But you are inside her when you paint, and you like the pink embankments of her shoulders. A certain muscular ditch is flawless between two points. You can find both sides of her later. She gives you her colors when you scrape her down and layer her again with rose madder bleached by repetitions of white in the width of big embankments, as if you thought of her as a road to somewhere called dedication to light. Everything sifts through the painter's torso, which is central, in spite of gradual deficits and paired helical filaments. Like a plasterer laying thin coats of sparkling paste, incised with charcoal, turning, staring at nothing, the hand holds the hard paint tube, oozing fresh pigment, stretched and trimmed. Yet her swollen red passages in crystalline absence and array. Drawing from early numbed chatter, trailing bright ridges of silence, or the lost year he tried to open her smearing apart. Again and again, pour of turpentine, plaques and tangles, roughly proportional to loss. Notebook 6, making more white. Takes little, blows it, if floating, a string, old month in, erase, body entirely, parabola air. You swim, room says this, but inside her paint, pink bank of her, muscular, between two can find sides, scrape her down with rose, bleached in width, if you thought a road where light. Thing sifts through torso, spite of deficit, helical, laying thin coats, incised charcoal staring, tube oozing, and trimmed, yet swollen red, absence array, from numb chatter trail, silence, lost ear opening, smearing. Again pour, plaque, and tangle, roughly. Notebook 7. The track of de Kooning's hand. the track of my mother's hand. Notebook 8. When you stand among the paintings, I stand among the paintings. They make a sharp swerve away, I swerve away, from what his name attaches to, or a leaning into prodigality of, leaning, leaning, and pink and yellow hallways empty of the highly composed, empty. Misogynist greens we've come to know and not know. Brushwork gives way to bounded forms that appear to be drawn and filled in as if mannerizing his own flesh, her flesh. Exhaled and gone, gone. Notebook 9, disappearing lines on snow, pulling his stroke along the dark granular table, grains of going away, frequently dragging dust into white, thereby folding himself into her and leaving her. Thank you. Bob, I know.